From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Nobody knows anything. The late William Goldman famously wrote about the alchemy of success in Hollywood. Now comes Jennifer Traeg to make much the same case about parenting. Traeg, as to parenting rules, says Robin Hood is the laws of Nottingham. She observes them at a great distance and with an even greater disdain. Traeg, a writer, memoirist, and mother of two, writes with evident frustration that children are baffling, mysterious little machines that most of the time can't even tell you what's wrong. This hour On Point, does anyone know anything about raising their kids? Parents of all ages and stripes, we want to hear from you. What were some of the worst pieces of advice you received? And what were some surprising lessons you reached for yourself? And I also want to hear from people in the medical and psychological professions. People do childcare. I'd love to hear what pieces of family folklore or received wisdom did you have to help your patients unlearn? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Or feel free to hit me up on Twitter. My handle is simply at David Folkenflik. From Ann Arbor, Michigan, we kick off our conversation with the author Jennifer Traeg. In previous books, she's written about her hypochondria and her religion-focused OCD. Her new book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. From the ancient Greeks to John Locke to the Johns Hopkins Medical School to Dr. Spock to every mommy blog right now, Traeg catalogs the alarming to the merely comical and takes on conventional wisdom of our own age. Jennifer Traeg, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Jennifer, for the love of God, what prompted this?
Well, when I had my kids, you know, my husband and I thought we knew how hard it would be. Our friends had had kids by that point. We had nieces and nephews. We'd seen it, but we really did not know what the day-to-day was like, and we were overwhelmed. And, you know, my husband's a professor. I'm a writer. Our skills did not transfer to our new lives, so I did the only thing I knew how to do, which was to start reading. And started doing a deep dive into old parenting advice books, histories of parenting, and it made me feel much better right away because parents had been making just the worst possible mistakes for millennia, and yet we had survived.
And yet we had all survived. I want to allow you, I read the book, but I want to start at the very beginning. You have this very apt introductory anecdote to sort of explain a little bit about the degree to which you were able to install order in your world with kids in your lives. Kick us off with that.
Though we think of having children as the most natural thing in the world, actually becoming a parent has taught me that there's nothing natural about it, and to pretend otherwise leads only to trouble. A short time ago, I followed my natural impulse to nap on the rug while my young son followed his to deface, in hot pink marker, the floor, the wall, the velvet couch, a lamp, an electrical socket, and a coffee table book lengthily inscribed by a former first lady. Had we been at home, this would have been irritating, but we were staying at someone else's house, so it was mortifying. Sam was being Sam, I explained helplessly when my husband came to survey the wreckage. It's just his nature. Did you fall asleep? He asked. That's my nature. This mess is on you too, Rob answered, shaking his head. Let's not drag nature into it. And while I thought it might be nice if Rob had fought his nature to be right about this particular matter, we both knew he was. From the cocktail of chemicals that brought our two children into the world to the countless perverse decisions we've made every day since, the only role nature has played is scapegoat.
So, you know, I mean, you make the case in your book that it almost doesn't matter whether or not you ship Junior off to military academy or, you know, you spend your time knitting together an organically constructed scooter for her to ride on, you know, after she has been served kale shakes from her hot yoga session. So who are we doing all this for?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, it's interesting that Judith Rich Harris, who died this week, and in her book *The Nurture Assumption*, made a really good case for the fact that what you do does not matter that much. That your kids will be shaped much more by their peers. So I think we're doing it for other parents. We're doing it for our peers. A lot of the parenting decisions I make are not because I think they'll be best for my children, but because I don't want the neighbors to see me yelling at my children anymore. I don't want them to know that I send my kids to school with fruit roll-ups. So it's peer pressure for parents just as much as it is for kids.
It's a little bit like a lot of people think about Instagram, you know, sort of performatively your best self.
Yes, exactly, exactly, which is why I am not on Instagram.
Let me ask you about that. Let me push back a little bit. You know, my understanding was that actually certain things did matter. That, for example, there was an argument made, well, maybe the college you choose doesn't matter so much, but maybe having a kid, if you're able to afford it, if through your own finances or through public assistance or whatever, you know, having strong preschool, certain kind, there are certain things along the way that do make a difference. And that the idea that it's really all agnostic and kids are going to be who kids are going to be doesn't quite hold up. It matters in some way.
Sure. There's a level, it's the phrase is the good enough parent. And below a certain threshold, you really do get into trouble. But it's a pretty, it's a sliding glass door rather than a transom. You don't have to be the best to be pretty great. You really, showing up is most of it.
I think at one point you write that your daughter's second word was Oprah, which should give us all a decent idea of how you spent your time parenting in some ways.
That is true, yes.
That is absolutely true. I want to ask a little bit, as you did this sampling through history, as you dip into the centuries, as you go back to the classics, in thinking about how to deal with nettlesome child, and God knows, what you have in here is alarming when it comes to babies, basically, whether it's childbirth or essentially leaving them out on hillsides for exposure if they seem a little weak or you know, basically just giving them away. But let's look for in our discussion a little bit about dealing with kids and the troubles that come up as kids evolve, right? What are some of the most outrageous truths that were accepted over the years that clearly in retrospect must have been false and must be in some ways counterproductive?
The one that puzzles me the most maybe is that children wouldn't acquire human form unless you actively imposed it upon them, which is what led to sort of mummifying your kids in swaddling. I mean, just very rigid head-to-toe swaddling. It could take up to 2 hours to change, so it was not changed often, which meant they were just doing in their own filth all the time. But it was felt that if you did not do that, they would not acquire two legs and two arms and a recognizably human shape.
Mm-hmm. We've got a bunch of people writing in, calling in. People call parenting blogs mommy blogs, but obviously moms are not the only parents involved and women aren't the only gender that care. We've got a call from St. Johnsbury, Vermont from Peter. Peter, go ahead.
Oh yeah, absolutely not. I mean, I'm pretty involved in my kids' parenting, and I take pride in that. The one thing I'd like to point out is I have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I totally agree that a lot of what we do is designed to, from a, like you said, with Instagram. But the point I'd like to make is, I realize that parenting style is a very sensitive topic, almost like religion and politics, and the advice I give to anyone who's about to have a child is don't, or who has a child and thinks they're doing it right, is don't offer advice to future parents unless asked. Do not volunteer advice. It's the worst thing you could do. I have said that as a parent who thinks he's doing things pretty right, I will never offer advice to anyone unless they ask, because it's just something that's just, it's fraught, totally fraught. So.
Well, Peter, I want to salute you for having almost godly levels of self-restraint. I imagine at Jennifer Traig, hard to do. Thanks so much for the call, Peter.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the original meaning of advice, which we sort of forget, is judgment. And I think that's how we use it most of the time, that, you know, when we're telling somebody how to raise their kids, it's because we're judging them for doing it wrong.
I want to go now to Tampa, Florida. Brian, sounds like you got a particularly pointed piece of advice when it came to your parenting issues.
Yeah, I right around the time of the crisis, I had gained
the financial crisis
with my daughter. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents gave me some horrible advice. They said, I beg your pardon.
Go ahead. I think we had a little feedback. Try again, Brian.
Okay. I was trying to determine what to do. You know, should I move back to there in Atlanta? And they said, you know, I'm sorry. I'm a little nervous.
No, it's okay. We're here for you.
Yeah. I had lived in Las Vegas and they were in Atlanta, and I had just gotten custody of my daughter, like I said. And I was trying to decide what to do after the crisis. And they said, look, why don't you go back into your business or your field, which took me overseas for a lot of the time, and we'll watch your daughter for you. And I, you know, looking back, I think that was the worst advice I had ever taken. You know, I wasn't there from the time she was 10 to the time she was 14. And, you know, we just drifted apart. Now we hardly speak at all. So it was very, you know, it's looking back, it's very troubling to me. Had I had a chance to do it again, I would have stayed and been a part of her life.
Brian, thank you. I can understand why you'd be a little tentative about sharing that. That's a rending lesson to learn. I appreciate your sharing it with our listeners. Jennifer Traeg, I realize he's now, he resigned from the Senate in disgrace, but I remember reading a line by Al Franken where he said something along the lines of, I'm not great at quality time, but I'm great at quantity time. We only have a little bit of time left before our first break, but how important is being present?
You know, I think that's really the whole job. I spend a lot of time repeating the mantra. I am not my children's entertainment committee. I'm, you know, just there to be there and to make sure they're safe. But I don't have to program the day. A lot of the stuff we do is really just bells and whistles and all the extra stuff that just exhausts us. We don't need all of that.
Give me examples of two things quickly that we don't need to do that you would sort of exile from parents' repertoire.
Certainly playing your children music while they're in utero, unless you enjoy the music yourself. There is no point in that. You're going to have a lot of time when they're out.
I'm good with Mozart at any age. We're going to come right back. If you're listening to the author, Jennifer Traeg, we're talking about the history of parenting. You can join the conversation. Where do you look for support? And what advice has led you astray? What surprising advice do you have for parents? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking with the author Jennifer Traeg about her new book, Act Natural, A Tour of the History of Parenting. You can join the conversation. How did you navigate the world? How did you navigate the world of parental advice? Along with the delights and joys, we'll be exploring the polar opposites of guilt and resentment. What have you learned from being a parent? What advice drives you nuts? Find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I wanted to take a call now from Boston, Massachusetts. Eliza, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm so glad you're doing this topic.
I am a
therapist. I work with families in Boston, mostly with families that have children that have various mental health diagnoses. And I think one of the myths that I've encountered the most, and I find to be the hardest to sort of deconstruct, is this idea of respect, is that kids should always respect their parents no matter what, and that's a given. And so a lot of times I end up having to spend time with a parent asking them, like, what does respect actually mean to you? How did you respect your parents when you were little? How is respect shown to you? And just sort of helping them understand that respect doesn't just happen because they're a caregiver, that you really have to model the behaviors that you want to see your kids show you.
So let me turn the question back on you and say, what does that mean to you? Like, why is respect an issue that is important for you to home in on?
Because I feel like it usually gets in the way of the parent maybe being a little bit more introspective and looking at what their own behaviors have done to sort of make their own child feel a lot of times disrespected. Mm-hmm. So it's that old lesson of you can't get respect if you don't give it. And even with little kids, you can't just expect that they're going to respect you as their parent if you're not showing them that you're invested in the relationship, that you understand what they're going through, and that you're modeling for them how you express anger and frustration and sadness.
Mm-hmm. And respect being more than just the trappings of being civil and obedient.
Exactly. Like, obedience is one thing, but in the long run, I find that, you know, you may be able to press your child to do what you want them to do chores, to say that they respect you. But in the long run, I haven't seen that the relationship between caregiver and child has actually improved. If anything, the kiddo ends up being resentful, ends up acting out in other ways. And then the parents are sort of like, why is this happening? I'm the caregiver. You know, I provide for them, and they're still not respecting me as a parent. And I'll also say as a disclaimer that I am not a parent. I don't have kids. I'm in this funny position of having to give advice to caregivers, as well as just trying to help them to be more introspective rather than just dole out advice. It's asking them questions.
Well, thank you so much for your insight, your professional insight, and the humanity of your approach. I will say I learned from Jennifer Traeg's book how often it is the case that people giving advice don't have kids. And I don't think that should be should rule them out as possible sources of good information. As a parent, Jennifer Traeg, you know, it seemed to me in reading your book, there are times you really wanted a certain degree of respect or just the kids to listen to what you had to say and of kind of throwing your hands up at times. How true did what our caller just say strike you?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, and it's something I actually haven't thought much about, which I'm ashamed to say. Mostly in our house, you know, respect manifests as trying to get my children to refer to adults by Mr. or Mrs., which at present they reserve, a title they reserve for animals. So my son, you know, will call for Mr. Squirrel, but refers to the chair of his father's department as Chuck. And it makes me think a lot about how we're modeling respect in the home. My New Year's resolution last year was to yell less. Because I realized what I was teaching them. And when they yelled back at me, which felt very disrespectful, I knew where they learned it. On New Year's Eve this year, they said, you know, we'd made progress. So that's the one thing we got done last year.
I wanted to turn now to a call also from Boston, Massachusetts. Erin, please join us.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. I'm calling as a mother of four, Facebook group victim, a mommy Facebook group victim, and I've been taking care of kids in one capacity of another for 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest gripe I have with any kind of parenting advice whatsoever, and I've had a lot of it thrown at me, is that none of it makes any sense for the individual child. We're not paying attention to the fact that children are individuals just as much as we are. What worked great for you and your child might not work well for me. And we have to stop trying to take this one-size-fits-all approach to parenting, because it's just not, it's going to lead to frustration. It's going to lead to more parental guilt and feeling like a failure. And it's just kind of a recipe for disaster.
Erin, can you give me an example of some advice you saw that what you feel victimized you from Facebook group or a parenting blog that could help our listeners understand where you're coming from on that?
Sure. I had a woman from Australia really lay into me for doing Cry It Out with my son when he was 11 months old, and basically tell me that I was abusing and neglecting my child for doing it, even though as a working mother, I was up with him twice a night, nursing him and everything like that. And she would not dare to do it with her child. And it came off of as very condescending and judgy. And I knew in my heart it was what was right for my son. I couldn't do what others have called the Ferber method of going in and checking on him, because that would make him more hysterical. So I just had to kind of rip the Band-Aid off and do it. And if you look at the science, that's the other thing that's lacking, is that we don't trust parents to make educated decisions. We don't educate them on the biology and the psychology of children and let them make the choice themselves. So, I mean, some children, when they cry, it's to get everything out. They kind of cry and then they fall asleep. And some children just escalate themselves. My son was able to cry, get it out, fall asleep. Meanwhile, my one-year-old daughter, if I leave her to do that, then she's just going to work herself up into a lather, and I can't. And that's just an example of, like, your piece of advice, what works for you and your child, doesn't apply to me in my life. Well, and Aaron, now you've also made me feel like a terrible person for doing it.
Well, we think you're a wonderful person for calling in to share with us that observation, and I appreciate that insight. Jennifer Traeg, there's an element in your book on page 82 where you talk about these baffling, mysterious little machines. Pick up that brief passage for us.
Sure. Children are baffling, mysterious little machines that are always beeping and breaking. Unlike my printer, which kindly directs me to clear paper jams or add more toner, most of the time they can't even tell you what's wrong. The books, however, can, and the answer is usually simple. It's you. You're doing it wrong. Your incompetence may be due to your inexperience or the mistakes of your own parents, to your gender, your social class, or your nationality, to the bad advice of other experts, or to simple stupidity. Lucky for you, there's a cadre of experts who won't let their lack of knowledge get in the way of telling you what to do. Unlike past experts, today's tend to be reasonably qualified, if far less entertaining.
So joining us now for the conversation from Berkeley, California, is Carvell Wallace. He's a writer. He's co-host of Slate's Mom and Dad Are Fighting podcast and co-author of Slate's Care and Feeding column. He has two teenagers, and before his writing career, he spent 15 years working with incarcerated youth, foster youth, and at-risk youth. Carvell, great to have you join us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, David.
So first off, help us out. Parenting blogs, scourge of the nation, or helpful resource?
As the person who like pays rent from parenting blogs,
I was going to say, don't think about your paycheck at all in this response.
No, I think they're kind of like closer to scourge of the nation, largely because of the fact. And I think this is what we try to do with the podcast and with the show is like, for me, I feel like a lot of the advice that I give boils down to trying to deprogram parents from the kind of obsessive compulsive belief that there is a perfect way that you can do it. And that if you just organize everything correctly, then you'll end up with a perfect result child. And if you don't get the perfect result child, which means a child that does exactly what you want at all times, then it must be because you're not doing stuff organized and well enough. And so I feel like a lot of the thing that I feel like is necessary to say as a advice giver or whatever it is I am now is that is like, okay, it doesn't work that way. You're not going to align everything and set the right bedtime and have the right rules and say these words, but never say these words. And then as a result you don't spit it all into a machine and have it like result in a perfect child. It's not a mathematic function. Kids are individuals, kids are people. As we know, there's no set of rules that you would apply to all human beings on the planet and have them all react the exact same way. Kids are in fact part of human beings on the planet. They're people. And so there is some fluidity and some confusion and some softness and some things that don't work out the way you want. And that's fine. And so then a part of what you have to do is figure out where to find yourself in all that, how to keep your bearings, how to keep your kind of like mental and emotional self intact. Because one thing, even though we don't know everything that does work, one thing that we know can be problems is super stressed out, aggressive parents who feel really badly about themselves, foisting those feelings onto their kids. We're pretty sure that that is bad all the way around. So I think a lot of what I try to do is try to like get parents out of that state, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Jennifer Traeg, you look at, among other things, besides your, the broadsides you launch at various advice columns, you look at some of the advice over the, not only the years, but over the centuries. You point about the British philosopher John Locke and the Enlightenment and his inspiration of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau, a French philosopher, writes an allegorical novel called Emile, and you write about you say, listen, he may have been speaking metaphorically, but he suggests that parents wear fright masks and this is, I kid you not, fire pistols near their children's heads to make them less skittish, expose them to spiders to make them less
squeamish, discontinue all formal education and ban all books. The young ones should basically be outside in all seasons, just in all climates, just basically running around in nature. And then he basically reaches out to one of the parents who had been corresponding with him and saying, this is what I've been doing and we've been having some trouble. And he said, I cannot believe that you took the book for a real treatise on education. Like, what are you doing paying attention to me? Even in our own age, how well do things that are accepted as strongly reliable, people like Dr. Spock over the years, held up to scrutiny as they recede a little bit the distance?
Yeah, first let me say that Carvell gives much better advice than Rousseau does. I read him religiously, and I find him tremendously reassuring. And Rousseau was, you know, if not clinically insane, the advice he gave is just so bizarre. It became hugely popular. It was, you know, sort of the equivalent of, it was very trendy, like, you know, infant yoga of the day, even though it was tremendously unpleasant to implement. I mean, it just meant
crazy tunes, even in the time.
Yes, yes. It was results that were demonstrably bad. Kids died, and the ones that didn't just turned out into real jerks. I mean, they weren't socialized, and Rousseau met at least one of them, was horrified by what his methods had produced. And even though he said, I can't believe you're using this as an actual parenting volume, he was corresponding with parents. You know, he was certainly profiting from it. It boosted his career. And the fact that he was so popular just sort of demonstrates how desperate parents are for advice. And as does Spock's success. Fortunately, he was much more reasonable when he came along. His book, I think the only book that's outsold it is the Bible. But yeah, he suffered a backlash too when it was thought, you know, that when the baby boomers turned out to be wilder than their parents expected, and he was faulted for that.
Well, as they always said during the Enlightenment, you know, Rousseau should be taken seriously, but not literally.
Exactly.
I'd like to take a call now from Hampton, Virginia. Fred, weigh in here. Help us out.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Okay.
I just called to say that I kind of disagree with the idea that we actually can't be good at parenting, that we just do the best we can and we just hope for the best. But it seems that I've seen successful families, I've seen to actually well-behaved children, and it seems that there is an underlying theme to it. I like to call it self-sacrifice, where parents study their children. And they use the opportunity that they have to train them to be actually good people. The world that they're going to be exposed to is not going to teach them how to be a good friend, how to be a good husband, how to be a good wife, how to problem solve. We have a unique opportunity when they're in our care to do those things. And if, of course, those things have to be in us first, but we can actually be successful at raising good people. And studying these little people, and when they become adults, they will draw on the things that we've taught them throughout their life, as opposed to just, you know, hoping for the best and just knowing, feeling we've done the best in our heart, but actually devoting time and energy to raising good people, if that makes any sense.
Thank you for that, Fred. What do you think, Carvell Wallace? Is this self-sacrifice?
I actually agree a lot, and I think one of the things that I have kind of evolved on over the, you know, 15 years of being a parent, and for 7 of those I was a stay-at-home dad, and plus just being in Berkeley, where it's like in like the Berkeley Oakland area, where there's just a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of hand-wringing about kid raising, because there's a lot of time and disposable income, and those things always add up to a little bit of hyper obsession. I think that what it is that parenting, I think the caller makes a really great point. And parenting is almost like it's this particular combination of role modeling and lesson planning, right? And so like role modeling is just kind of like sort of like who you are just as a person. And what your kids pick up from that. And then lesson planning is this idea that, like, if I do this and say this and don't do this and don't allow that and do allow that, that I'll get these outcomes that I want. And I think that one of the major problems with, like, the whole advice racket and just the way that we as a capitalist consumer society tend to think of parenting is that we think that it's, like, 90% lesson planning. That if we put all the things in order, then we'll get the result we want. And I think what the caller is saying and what I tend to see is it's more like 80% role modeling, 20% lesson planning. The vast majority, it seems to me, of what kids get from you has to do with who you are. And if you're doing a lot of lesson planning, like these are my roles and this is what I want and this is how we're going to organize your baby yoga classes or whatever, but in the process of doing that, what you're role modeling is someone who's hyper obsessive, self-centered, and stressed out, then that's what your kids are learning. It doesn't matter what the baby yoga class is teaching them. That's kind of the way I see it.
We are discussing parenting through the ages. We're discussing parenting right now. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Kathleen Goldtar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat this story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're discussing parenting in our modern age. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now is Jennifer Traeg, author of the new book Act Natural, and Carvell Wallace, writer and parenting advice columnist and podcaster with Slate. Let's take up the hidden name in the room. Jennifer Traeg, you went back and looked at some of the things that we rely on to entertain and sort of help our kids evolve in terms of their thinking, how we read things like the Brothers Grimm, who turn out to be, deeply violent, probably misogynistic, certainly anti-Semitic in their writings. And then let's talk about Disney. You know, I remember, Bambi's mom taking it on the chin in pretty much minute one of that movie, right? You have Sleeping Beauty, parents are basically absent. The Lion King, the dad gets killed. Frozen, both parents are dispatched early on. You didn't get directly at this in the book, but what is going on with Disney there? Why are why are parents expected to serve up fare to their kids in which parents are erased?
Yeah, I don't know. And it's not just Disney. I mean, even sitcoms will usually get rid of at least one parent. And I think part of it is because, these are directed at kids, and watching the parents interact with each other and with the children is not nearly as interesting to the audience, which is the children, as watching children interact with the world, which I think is the point of most of those, from Grimm to Disney to, the kind of dumb sitcoms on children's channels, is to prepare kids for, the world they're going to enter. It's sort of helping them imagine, when they're on their own and their parents aren't making all their decisions for them.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Carvell? I mean, I with my own kids, one of them reacts fine to some of this stuff even at a relatively young age, and the other seizes upon it.
Yeah, it's funny you brought this up because both my kids have noticed this trend, not only in movies and television, but definitely in books like YA novels and even like the sort of children's, like the first chapter books that kids read starting around, whatever age and then getting into fourth grade. Frequently the setup is that, a parent dies and then the kid has to go live with the distant relative and it's weird, or the dad disappears and the parent, kid doesn't know what happened to them. And those are the books that my kids always read. And the one they've brought up that this is like a weird obsession of like these content creators. And I think one of the things they told me is that it probably has a lot to do with the fact that that's a little bit of a kid fantasy. Not that they lose their parent or that tragedy befalls the person they love, but that part of the fantasy of being a kid is you having to deal with the world on your own. You have to fight the monsters. You have to battle the aliens. You have to like get all the spy gear and take down like the international, like convoy of bad guys. Like, that's part of the fun of it. And so no kid wants to see a bunch of parents, like, you know, having to do all that.
Hey, let's watch the new Disney film, Mom Solves All Our Problems.
Exactly, while they sit in the back seat and are told to be quiet and stop fighting. Like, in their fantasies, they're the ones who are out there at the front taking on all the action. So I think it has a lot to do with that.
And think about all these loving step-parents or, you know, guardians or other people out there who are like, boy, we're never going to cut a break from this stuff. But, you know, you make a point on that. It does get us to this other fundamental question that we hear about all the time. Jennifer, you write about it a bit in the book. You say there is TV, and in the end, this is the substitute caregiver we always turn to. In our home, we do not emphasize attachment parenting, but connection of another time, the entertaining tether of premium cable. It is expensive, but given how much our children watch, it's far less than the hourly rate we would pay a human to keep them occupied. And when concerned outsiders recite the data showing how very bad it is for our children to have this much screen time, my husband and I tune them out, a skill we both learned as children when our own mothers, stuck at home without adequate childcare themselves, relied on the very same sitter. I want to hear each of you weigh in on this, because this is the discussion that comes up in almost every parenting conversation one has. Screen time is now not just TV, but cell phones and tablets and Kindles and the like. In your case, Jennifer, why is it cool? Why is it okay?
Okay, number one, it isn't, and I feel tremendously guilty about it. And we've maybe gotten a little bit better about it. I was ready to say no more. I'd done a lot of the reading about, it's not great. And then I read The Wonderful Mothering Memoir by Rivka, I think, Galchen, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, who is probably the smartest writer I've ever read, and she admits that she watched unlimited TV while she was a child. So I went back on deciding that, okay, you watch as much TV as you want, because look how well she turned out. We rely on it way too much. And my kids have now migrated from TV, which they hardly watch at all, to screens, which they watch constantly, so they can watch anywhere. And, yeah, things will be changing in 2019, I hope.
What do you think, Carvel? How do you feel about screens?
I feel like it's probably – I mean, I view it as a battle that we sort of have lost. Right. Like I view that and the
we, you or
battle,
we as a society,
we as well, I can only speak for me and my kid's mom. I think we both view this as like when they were these little tiny babies and we said, we're only going to feed them organic kale at all times. And they're going to watch 5 minutes of screen time a day for the rest of their lives. And that's going to be it. And it's going to be educational. And we just the extent to which we have completely lost that. I mean, like. My daughter, my lovely 13-year-old, just like will sit and eat hot Cheetos and watch like Netflix sitcoms for like 5 hours. And like, it's just like, we can't intervene. We can't stop her. We try, but it's like at a certain point, what am I going to do? Physically go in there and throw stuff out the window. And I know that some parents want to do that, but I feel like I honestly feel as a parent, I have been defeated by that. I have lost that. I have not won. I don't have a great silver lining for it. I don't have a like, oh, it's not that bad. And maybe I'm overreacting. It's just like that is a thing that I wanted to do, that we wanted to do, which is like limit screen time. And we failed at that and our kids are lost. And so now we're just trying to operate cleanup. And a lot of that has to do with like the way I look at it. A lot of it has to do with helping the kids recognize on their own what the impacts are of multiple hours of screen time. And my son is starting to get there. He's starting to have a thing where he's like, where I kind of go into his room and they're like, hey, you've been in here watching YouTube for like 3 hours. You should probably go outside. And he'll be like, yeah, I probably should actually. You know what I mean? And he'll kind of like shake it off. But he's beginning to recognize that he has his own feelings when he holds up and watches screens for a long time that makes him feel not great. And I think that's the best we have at this point. But no, we did not win this. It is not good. It's not fine. We lost. Next question.
Well, it's funny because that seems to be where the default unstructured time goes, right, is a screen somewhere, whether it's a video game or Netflix or whatever. Whereas, you know, I remember it's, you know, probably been about 170 years, but I remember, you know, throwing mud pies in my friend Brian's backyard or shooting hoops with my friend Robert, on the street at the backboard that was up on a telephone pole across the street. And that was what we did. It wasn't like, hey, I blocked off, 2:45 to 4:15 to do this. It's like, that's just what you did till you came in. Then again, I do remember reading, I think it was back when David Letterman was on the air. They had, top 10 lists. The top 10 list was top 10 ways the world would be different if Ralph Nader had never lived. And I think number 4 or something was, we'd have piano wire seatbelts. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, we didn't always wear seatbelts or sometimes ever wear seatbelts. And nowadays kids are expected to have booster seats till they're what, 10, 12? Mm-hmm. It's a very different moment we live in. We are getting calls filling the lines. I want to take one now from Monroe, Connecticut. Alan is calling in. Alan, what do you think?
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. My name is Al. I'm a single dad to three boys, and I have been alone with them for 7 years. And mm-hmm. at the time, they were 11, 9, and 7. I was self-employed, and I had to let go of my work in order to be with them because I couldn't just let somebody else come in and watch them. So at the beginning of this show, you mentioned how you weren't their entertainment center or director. And I tried to be, but it was impossible with the three of them. And I pretty much did everything wrong in that because I was alone and because, I remember the shame of not being able to get my youngest, who is disabled, to school on time. He's hearing impaired, and mm-hmm. School wasn't working out for him because of his impairment, and the school wasn't meeting his needs. But at the time, I thought it was my failure, and I hadn't quite let go of work. And I remember thinking about how my son has absolutely no concept of what I think is important to me. And mostly it was, like I said earlier, motivated by my shame of failure because I didn't really have any experience in parenting and I wasn't sure how to do it. And I want to say for video games or screen time, when I was a kid, we were out after school till it was dark enough to come in and then we watched TV after dinner. But we weren't always just making mud pies. We were throwing rocks at cars and we were smoking pot. And so I don't want to say that it's just I'm very lucky that it's taken all this time in 7 years because, and also too, I want to say that this show is the first time I feel I've been affirmed because I didn't have any reflection from anyone else. And it was really hard for me to reach out to other, I call them normal families. Not that I'm alone, because there are a lot of single parents, but it was very shaming and quiet, and this really has affirmed me. I want to thank you for the show.
Oh, thank you, Al, for that, and for, you know, I hope for other listeners too, you know, the feeling that you may not have mastery of this, it sounds like, is quite normal. Jennifer Traeg, it sounds like it's something that's very much part of the parenting experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And throughout history, I mean, we think of, you know, blended families or single parents as being the scourge of our time, but absolutely not. They were just as common, if not more common, in previous eras. And a round of applause to the caller who's doing this by himself. We don't do nearly enough to support families in this country, and it's far worse for single parents, and for single fathers probably get less support than anyone else. So hooray for him. You know, I hope he doesn't feel any shame. He should feel very proud for what he's managed to accomplish.
And I will say,
I just want to add one thing too. No, I just want to add one thing too that I always think about when it comes to this idea of perfection and parenting and who's doing it right. You know, you mentioned before that that the only book that outsold Dr. Spock's book was the Bible. And the Bible begins with, like, a parent not being able to control his kids. That's literally the first story in the Bible. It's like, that's like God. And the parent is God. And God is like, hey, don't eat those apples. And then the kids are like, right, I'm totally not going to eat them. And then they totally eat them. And then God's like, what did you do? And the kids are like, I don't know. We just ate them. We just, you know. And it's like, so that's literally the first human-like story, at least from the Bible's perspective. And so it's kind of like if the almighty, all-powerful can't make his kids listen, which I think is sort of the point of that story, then it's like you should not feel bad that you can't do it, because that's apparently the way it works.
And as one can recall, you know, it's not as though that's the only moment of child refusal to go along with parental directives.
A lot of bad parenting in the Bible.
Want to take another call now. We're getting a lot of dads calling in as well as moms, as well as others. But Mike, I wanted to take your call. You're calling from, I believe, Madison, Wisconsin. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, yeah, that's correct. United Front. My wife always says, we have to have a united front against. I had three boys, and when there's an issue, I a lot of times disagree, and then we end up arguing in front of them. And she tells me later, we're supposed to have a united front. What were you doing? You know, I was supposed to concede her point. So, recommendation there?
Well, thank you for the question, Mike. I guess the tension being whoever gets to speak gets to have the rule of the law whether you know it's more important to have a united front. Let's take our panel, see if their front is united on this. Carvel Wallace, tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that the united front thing is complicated, and it sometimes can be used to mask just like as like a euphemism for let me be in charge of everything. But I actually, that said, I do think it is important for that to happen to the extent that it can. And I will say that the way that we do it, even though my kid's mom and I aren't together anymore, we still have a pretty highly functional relationship. And what if there's a possibility for us to get on the same page before approaching a kid about a thing, we always take that opportunity. Like we just had a thing where I'm not going to embarrass either one of my kids, but a certain thing happened, and we found out that a thing had happened a month ago that we didn't know and that our kid hadn't entirely been honest about, and it came to light and it was a big deal. And we knew that we were going to have to talk with the kid about this particular thing. And so the mom and I got on the phone and we sort of said, okay, here's the deal. I just found out this information. These are the details I know. And then we had to go through our own negotiation process on the phone before we got in front of the kid about it, you know, and we had disagreements, and it was a little bit of a tense conversation. We had different points of view on what was important and what we should say. But I think we do feel like it is important to have a united front. Now, that said, again, I think a lot of times that phrase is used for one parent to just be like, listen to whatever I say and I'm in charge, and that's not great. But I think you have to – parenting is a negotiation between parents too. There's a negotiation between parents and kids, and there's a negotiation between the two parents. And anytime you have an opportunity to do that negotiation before getting in front of the kid, that's helpful. Sometimes you get in front of the kid because things pop up right in the middle and then no one has time to prepare. I feel like in our relationship, although every relationship is different for us, if my kid's mom is already on something and she's already laid down some organizations and some rules and some ideas and I disagree with them, I'm not going to bring them up right in that moment because there's already too many conflicts happening. I don't need to add another one. And I recognize that, and the reason I'm okay with that is because there's going to be another opportunity. The kids are going to give us plenty of opportunities to, like, have problems. So, like, I don't have to win every battle in the moment. But I think a united front is kind of important. I don't know.
So a vote for a united front from Carvel Wallace, a man who is co-host of a podcast called Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Carvel Wallace also writes Slate's Care and Feeding Parenting Advice column. Carvel, pleasure to speak with you today on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, we've also been hearing from Jennifer Traeg. She's the author of a lot of books, and her new book is Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and the Facebooks at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefana Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poley, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.